KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
Hi, I'm Kim Masters. Thanks for listening to The Business. Some of the most entertaining stories produced today aren't just on the big screen. They can be heard on KCRW's Unfictional. Intimate tales and artful documentaries crafted by some of the most talented radio producers across the globe. Check it out. You can find Unfictional on KCRW's iTunes page. From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
It's really, I think, intoxicating for a woman who's working, you know, 90-hour weeks to sit down and see somebody just flown around on a helicopter and taken care of just because she's pretty.
As a young woman working in television, ardent feminist Sarah Gertrude Shapiro found herself almost conscripted to work as a producer on The Bachelor. And she does understand the show's appeal. She tells us how she mined her ambivalence about that experience to create the new Lifetime series, Unreal, a dramedy set behind the scenes of a reality show that is not The Bachelor, except it kind of is. But first on the News Banter, the Murdochs show the world how Succession is done, and Brad Pitt goes to Netflix. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Kim.
So the big story is, of course, the Murdochs. You have to admire, regardless of how you feel about the Murdochs, and some people actually don't care for them, Mike.
I've heard that.
You have to admire the way they've executed this. Rupert Murdoch stepping aside as chief executive of his companies. He's got actually two companies, News Corp, the newspaper operation, and 21st Century Fox, which is the film and TV operation. And handing the reins to the two princes, his sons, James and Lachlan.
Right. We've been watching the chess pieces sort of line up in place for the past couple of years, actually, especially last year when he brought Lachlan much closer into the fold. He's been operating as a non-executive co-chairman for a while now. And now Lachlan will be sort of back in the game, even spending more time in L.A. But the big news, of course, is James Murdoch taking over the CEO role that Rupert formerly had and sort of cementing his power as the heir apparent of 21st Century Fox.
Right. Again, this is the film stuff and TV stuff, not the newspaper stuff. That's Lachlan's, I think, still his playground. Now, Lachlan had been sort of seen at one point as the heir to Rupert Murdoch. He had kind of a bumpy experience. You know, some of the senior executives at the time when this was happening several years ago, you know, they didn't really bend over to help Lachlan.
Right. Well, he was given sort of a sink or swim scenario
and
taking over television. But of course, at the time, he was dealing with powerful executives like Peter Chernin on the television side.
And Roger Ailes.
Roger Ailes, of course.
At the News Channel.
And who isn't about to give up his fiefdom. And even in this new scenario, is not giving up his fiefdom. He is the one exec who's still reporting directly to Rupert.
Yes, still hanging in there with Rupert Murdoch as his boss. And so what we see is we're told that the two brothers, you know, as I said, Lachlan will continue to be in charge of the newspaper division, which, you know, is not real popular with Wall Street for obvious reasons. Newspapers, not what they were. We are told that even though James is the chief executive and Lachlan is co-chief executive, that they will be like hand in glove running this operation. I'm assuming that maybe having something to do with how Rupert lured Lachlan back by saying he wouldn't just be relegated to one aspect, the less sort of appealing aspect of the company.
And meanwhile, the other big news is as James and Lachlan sort of cement their power at 21st Century Fox, we're saying farewell to Chase Carey, who has for many years been a part of Rupert's sort of inner circle, going way back to the launch of the Fox network and even helping him out during his years acquiring and then getting rid of DirecTV. Chase has been there. So with Chase departing, that sort of leaves it open for someone else to take over as the highest ranking non-Murdoch at the company. And it looks to be Peter Rice.
Yeah, well, that's a tradition. Chase Carey was preceded by Peter Chernin, who for many years was sort of the unofficial Murdoch son who wasn't named Murdoch and was never going to get adopted by Rupert Murdoch. So ultimately moved on. Chase Carey now is slowly moving on. It's not happening right this second, but that he will gradually in the next year or so, I think he's stepping down from the COO job, the chief operating officer. I don't think they'll immediately give this job to Peter Rice, but certainly he ran the film studio. He ran the television side. Now he's running it. It's going well. And he is that slick, political capable, very disciplined executive that seems to be of a sort of a type that Murdoch always has one of.
Yeah, and a fast learn. You know, he was thrown into the television side not knowing anything about that business.
He
and
swam.
Picked it up
yeah.
very quickly.
Yeah, he did. Let me just mention that Murdoch has four daughters, one of whom, Elizabeth, was involved in the entertainment business, but has stepped away from her dad's company, so it's all going to the boys.
Right. She owned a successful production company, Shine, but she eventually actually sold it to 21st Century Fox. For a lot of money, but now it doesn't look like she's in the picture.
Right. Moving on to Netflix again, making news. They picked up a project that was being shopped at Cannes, a Brad Pitt project based on General Stanley McChrystal's story. And the reason this is a big deal, A, they paid $30 million, Netflix did, for this. And this is the kind of film, prestige film, A-list star. You know, Netflix has been flirting with and getting into the movie business for a while now. They have a thing with Adam Sandler where he's going to do movies for them. But this kind of money and this kind of prestige play, you know, they're doing what they did in TV, trying to get into the awards game as they did with The House of Cards and you know, Orange is the New Black. They serious awards contenders. They're hoping this film will be the vehicle for that.
Yeah, I mean, it's smart in that these are the kind of mid-range films that, of course, the majors aren't doing anymore. And they're starting to do a bunch of them. They've got the Cary Fukunaga war drama, Beasts of No Nation, also on tap. And they're also cultivating, you mentioned Adam Sandler. But they're cultivating a big stable of comedy movies, the kind, again, that we're not seeing the majors do as much anymore, including one that they just announced with several Saturday Night Live cast members. They're doing the Pee-wee's Big Holiday movie. They've got a lot on tap.
Yeah, they're going to try and get some of these, not all, into theaters. Of course, theater owners, not necessarily the biggest fans of Netflix, but I imagine for at least some of the independent theaters, turning down a Brad Pitt movie might, you know, that if it has any kind of decent buzz will be hard. And then this comes from his company, Plan B, which had 12 Years a Slave, Selma. So, you know, they've shown that they can make films that are taken seriously as art house films. And that's what they're hoping this will be. And they will, in fact, be able to get some theaters.
Netflix disrupted television. Now they're about to disrupt movies.
They're going to try. Meanwhile, Disney a little bit disrupted. There were two major news stories in the very recent past, one in the Wall Street Journal, one in the LA Times, about fundamentally the greatness of Disney as it is run by Bob Iger, its chairman and CEO. And it came just before a rather large flop, Tomorrowland, $140 million, as looks like the size of that loss. Disney can afford it.
Absolutely. And when you look down the pike, of course, what's coming down the, you know, beyond the fact that Avengers Age of Ultron was a huge enough smash to sort of cover that up a bit. But they've got a new Pixar movie coming out in Inside Out, which is sure to be
great buzz on that.
Yeah,
one.
Mm-hmm. A phenomenon. And just looking down the next several years, what they have lined up, you know, Tomorrowland was hopefully for them an anomaly.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that is a big negative is certain analysts of what goes on in Hollywood are like, you know, this shows that it's very risky to do something. And they're calling this original, you know, because it's I don't know exactly how original it is. It's based on an attraction. And some people are saying this will dissuade the studios from taking big risks on properties that are not branded and known, like these comic books and characters and superheroes. I don't really think that's a reasonable takeaway, but it is surprising. Brad Bird, the director, has had an amazing track record, and it's a perfectly reasonable bet, and it's surprising that this one didn't work
right.
out.
Right. Don't forget George Clooney was the star, so, you know.
Not good for his brand either.
Not necessarily.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Kim.
That's Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. The newest season of the ABC reality series The Bachelor is now well underway, the 19th season of a show in which a pack of women compete to win the affections of a good-looking and usually white man.
Welcome to another rose ceremony. Our time here in paradise is getting shorter and shorter. For some of you, this is really working. Great relationships are being formed here. People are falling in love.
Sarah Gertrude Shapiro didn't set out to be a producer on The Bachelor. She wanted to be a filmmaker. But to pay the bills, she went to work on another reality show that was not quite so offensive to her feminist ideals. Then the production company reassigned her, and she learned all about the behind-the-scenes manipulation that pumps drama into a so-called unscripted series like The Bachelor. Under contract but desperate to get out, Shapiro says she finally made her escape by promising that she wouldn't work for a competing show and would even leave the state of California. She moved to Oregon and went to work for an ad agency. Meanwhile, Shapiro used her experiences to concoct Unreal, a new scripted series on Lifetime, set behind the scenes of a reality show called Everlasting. The fictional show involves a suitor, as opposed to a bachelor, who must choose from a flock of aspiring, unwitting, and otherwise damaged young women. The protagonist is a deeply conflicted young producer named Rachel, played by Shiri Appleby. In the pilot episode, Rachel surprises fellow crew members by returning to the set of Everlasting after she had vanished following an on-camera freakout the previous season.
Yeah. Be afraid, okay? Crazy's back. Don't everybody rush to hug me at one time.
Rachel's boss is Quinn, the demanding executive producer of Everlasting, played by Constance Zimmer.
Okay, come on, let's go, people. Protect the wifeys, Anna and Grace, and starve our villain, Brittany, until she is mean like a pit bull. I want to pickle the rest of them, okay? You get cash bonuses for nudity, 911 calls, cat fights, all right? Have a good show, everybody.
Shapiro says Everlasting is an exaggerated version of her own experience, but not by much.
I'm a feminist, card-carrying feminist, and I keep finding myself repeatedly in these really, like, abject, just deep in the bowels of the thing that I want to, like, disassemble.
So when you wanted to leave the whole game of reality, which I guess you decided you would finally hit the wall and you'd had enough.
Yep.
And they were like, are you going to work for Mark Burnett? Are you doing something with a competitor? And they wanted to kind of hold you to a non-compete and a contract and not let you out.
I think that was the culture at the time. And I actually don't have any idea how it is now. But I think it was just there were sort of insider secrets and there were just a lot of competing shows. And it was big, big money at the time. Like it was a big deal. So they didn't want me being poached. And I just really had to say, I can't physically, you know, I got to get out of here. I can't do it.
You just, like, said, I'm going to have a nervous breakdown.
Yeah. It was just, you know, it's one of those things where looking back on it now with a lot more maturity, there were a lot of different ways I could have handled it. But when you're that age and you just freak out and say, I got to go.
If you parse the burdensomeness of it, what is worse, the hours or the sort of spectacle?
For me, I think it was actually kind of like Faustian, you know, have I sold my soul to the devil? Am I living in a way that I can't live? And that, you know, in terms of my journey, it was really just about being able to look myself in the mirror and feel okay about what I was doing on the planet. And I don't know that everyone's wired that way, but I just happen to be wired that
way. So the content was more debilitating than the experience of making this stuff.
Yeah, for me it was. But I do think for crews in general, not even necessarily reality crews, but it's just really talking about, like, why are we doing this work? Why are we giving up our personal lives? What do we all care about so much that we show up here every day?
And we don't know the answer.
I think it's having a place to belong and being part of a work family. And also, the thing that I really kind of love about reality crews in my experience is that they are generally the kids who couldn't afford to go to film school or paying off their school debts, and because it's a job you can get. So it's like a very working class, very true blue, very loyal group of people who really love film but are just sort of doing a day job. Yeah, I think that just being that age where you don't really know who you are and you're too scared to decide your own life, having somebody tell you where to show up every day is pretty addictive.
I just want to take a little minute before we get into the show to talk about the things that people don't know about reality and things they think they know. There was an insight in stuff that I've read that you have said in interviews that I think is sort of interesting. For example, you talk about this kind of genesis where in the beginning, earlier days, let's say, when you were working there, people who came on these shows were more naive and they really did not know what they were getting in for. And as time went by, they were self-casting even. And you, like, the show would cast, and without announcing it to these people who come on the Bachelor, for example, they would be cast like, this is the villain, this is the good girl, whatever. And then they start getting it.
Yeah. Well, I think the shift that I noticed when I was in that field for a minute really was pretty profound, from initially people just sort of showing up and being like, I don't know, I got scouted and now I'm here. And then it was really, you know, the producer's jobs to manipulate the situations and sort of tell the stories. But it becomes a very different dance when the people in front of the camera are writing their own stories as well. And it becomes a little bit of a power struggle, because it's like, who's going to control the narrative here?
The job gets more difficult.
It gets much more difficult. But what I've seen just in general is that, like, we've sort of become like a panopticon or whatever it's called, where it's just constant watching. Like, people just feel constantly photographed and constantly watched. And so the idea of, yeah, like, curating yourself, narrating yourself, photoshopping yourself, presenting yourself exactly how you want. I mean, just sort of creating these lives. I think that the reality TV genre and the Facebook culture, Twitter culture, I think they all kind of go together.
Yeah, it's one of the other striking things I saw that you had said about reality. I mean, everybody says they know reality isn't real, but you said people still don't know exactly what they're signing up for here when they come on these shows. They may think they control the narrative, but they may not.
There is no way, unless you've actually been a producer on one of these shows or in the business, that you can actually understand what's going to happen, not only when you're edited, but also when you have no access to the outside world or your normal routine or your support system or even the food you normally eat or sleep and you're just plied with alcohol. You can't actually anticipate what that's going to feel like, nor can you understand the power of editing.
So you can think you said one thing and find yourself presented.
Absolutely. It's an unbeatable chess game.
And then on the viewer side, it's interesting because you said there was some kind of a study that the average viewer makes like $150,000 a year, has a master's mm-hmm. degree, which I find very amazing.
Yeah.
And obviously buying on some level into the Cinderella fantasy, I guess. But at the same time, you think they're into it, how phony it is.
Yeah, I think what we've talked about a lot is suspension of disbelief and really wanting to believe that's true because it feels so good to think that there's somebody who's going to like show up and change your whole life. It's just like an addictive, irresistible fantasy. And so, you know, I've talked about even like for me, who's like dyed-in-the-wool feminist, I still sometimes see a diamond and get a little woozy, you know? And it's like, what is it? Like, what
is it? What is the strange power?
Yeah, what is it in our DNA? Or just the idea that like you're pretty enough and thin enough to be loved. I think it's really, really addictive. And I also think that sort of outdated gender roles are really appealing too because at least people knew what their jobs were. I think it's part of the fascination with Mad Men, sort of a longing for a time when men and women knew what their roles were.
Mm, yes, I think about that sometimes.
Do you?
I do.
We think about it a lot.
I think about it because it is confusing in today's world. It's at least hypothetically wide open, not necessarily in fact wide open. But what about that phoniness? You think they like to sort of go, ha-ha, I know that's fake because I'm smarter than the people on who are other people watching?
Yeah, well, definitely, you know, the pure, like, vitriol and pleasure of, like, you know, somebody who was a nerd in high school or fat in high school or fat now just, like, ripping the prom queen in half. I mean, just feeding on our blood. Like, it feels good. And it feels good to watch these girls be really stupid, you know? You know, there's one thing where it's sort of like, look at them, they're so stupid and, like, living out their dumb princess fantasy. But suddenly you're watching it and you sort of wish you were them.
You're
and
one
I just
of them.
Think,
uh-oh.
Yeah, and that it's really, I think, intoxicating for a woman who's working, you know, 90-hour weeks and just, like, busting her ass at her career to sit down and see somebody just flown around on a helicopter and taken care of just because she's pretty.
The 90-hour weeks, that's what you work when you're on these shows. I mean, one of the things that your show illustrates is this horrendous life of the crew. There's one sequence where the character who's kind of you-ish. Not officially you.
No.
Is sleeping on some kind of a bunk with curtain in front of the bed and wakes up and kind of has a little portable toothbrush and can't even get a shower, basically, in this disgusting little space. And I guess that is exaggerated or not?
The interesting thing is a lot of people who wrote on the show, we had like six writers, and they've all worked on sets, not even reality, and they were like, it's totally possible. Because sometimes it's just not practical to drive home. And also sometimes you just, you know, you can't really maintain a home life when you're working like that. So that wasn't a stretch at all.
And yet people do it.
Absolutely they do it.
Because?
I mean, I think that gets into the whole issue of workaholism. And also, you know, a big theme for us is just sort of women and work. And if you choose to have a career and that's what you hang your hat on and that's what you really are driving towards, part of that is annihilating some of your selfhood and sort of giving up a lot of agency and a lot of choice. And I think there's a ton of anxiety in the problem of too many options, too many decisions, and having to be the author of your own life is really, really scary. So if you just get annihilated by work, you stop having to decide. You don't really have to decide what you're doing every day. And you can just complain about your boss and say how f***ed up your job is instead of saying, I can't stand to be a person. I can't stand to make a life. I can't stand to be vulnerable. I can't stand to, you know, try for what I believe in. It's so much easier to just be angry.
Coming up after a short break, Shapiro tells us how an ad agency ended up producing the short film that led to Unreal. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW's popular iPad Music Mine app is now available for the iPhone. From quick discovery to deep exploration, take KCRW music with you wherever you go. Download at kcrw.com/musicmind.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to former reality show producer Sarah Gertrude Shapiro, co-creator of the new Lifetime dramedy, Unreal. The series got its start with a short film, Sequin Rays, which Shapiro wrote and directed after she walked away from working on The Bachelor. Both the short and the TV series, Unreal, focus in part on the mutually manipulative relationship between producer and contestant. In Sequin Rays, Ashley Williams plays the producer and Anna Camp is the contestant.
I know you're tired. We just have to talk about last night, and then you can totally go home.
No, I'm not doing that.
You want to talk to me about the contract you signed?
I wrote it when I was living in Portland and was going to try and make it in Portland, but realized it was such an intense performance piece. It's like a 20-minute scene that I really needed incredible actors. And I ended up doing it through the AFI directing workshop for women, which is like if you get in, 8 women get selected a year. It's free if you get in. And then I came down here and made it with them.
How do you get into the AFI workshop for women?
You have to have a reel and you submit a script, which is like they consider you and your script, and then you get admitted to a summer program.
You had a reel. How did you have the reel, I guess, the question.
Oh, that's actually interesting. So I was working at an ad agency in Portland called Wieden & Kennedy, where I was directing some stuff, but I also had written little shorts on the side and done music videos. So I just put together what I had. And a lot of people that apply for the program feel like really intimidated because they don't really have a reel. So what I did is I wrote like a scripted short and shot it on a weekend with a friend and just put it together. But I had a lot of resources in terms of like an edit facility and all of these things through work.
Through the ad agency.
And they ended up being the primary funder of my short and were incredibly supportive to me the entire time. And are actually executive producers on the show. Sally DeCipio from Wieden & Kennedy is a executive producer. So yeah, so I put together a reel and it's pretty hard to get in. It's pretty competitive, which is good. I think it keeps the quality way, way up and it's an incredible program. And so then I came down and then I just got my dream cast for my short. I ended up, Frances Conroy, who was the mom on 6 Feet Under, was in it, and Anna Camp and Ashley Williams, and they were great.
So you do that and then what was interesting to me was that your initial starting point was, I want to be a filmmaker.
Totally.
But you didn't necessarily think of this as a movie, a long feature film.
Well, I think if I had done it 5 years ago, I would have. I just think television is in beyond a golden age. It's kind of like it's taken over for me. I think it's so much more interesting in terms of a space to work in. And also the idea had a show within the show structure. So it just was like a natural for TV.
Right. I mean, I could see it as a film.
I could, too. We definitely talked about it. I just think the middle has dropped out of indie film so much that I don't know where I would have gone with it, because it kind of would either have to be mumblecore or a bigger movie, and it's not really either.
Right.
It needs a lot of ponies and dresses and sequins and mansions, so it's, like, hard to make a – you know what I mean? It's hard to make a mumblecore movie in a mansion.
Yeah, so that's ponies and mansions. Yeah. They're difficult to do.
Yeah.
I saw that you pitched it to Lifetime, and I don't know to how many places you actually did pitch it, but you had no agent. That's an unusual thing.
That was pretty weird, yeah. Sally DeCipio, who I worked with at the ad agency, she had been in Hollywood. Like, she worked on Felicity, and she was working on all that kind of scripted stuff, and then had gone to Portland and took me under her wing. And she knew Nina Lederman at Lifetime. And I was sitting at my desk, and she said, you want to fly down to L.A. tomorrow? And then I flew down to L.A., so.
And did you go Lifetime? What?
I sure did. Yeah, I sure did.
I mean, you must have been thinking
HBO, Netflix.
FX, maybe.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I never would have thought of it, and Nina Lederman just bowled me over. I mean, like, she looked me in the eye and said, I absolutely want to make this, and I want to make your short. And I was really, really confused. I didn't know anyone. I have a cousin who was like a screenwriter in the 80s. I called her. I called 2 other people I knew in town from AFI who had done a little bit of TV. And they sort of unanimously said, look, you know, passion is kind of the most important thing. If you really feel from them that they want to make this, they want to buy it in the room, they want to make it, I would go for it. And I'm just like, what are they going to do with me? And I said that to Nina. I said, I'm really, like, really broken, and it's really dark. And she said, yeah, I can tell. I can tell.
Is this a brand realignment for a lifetime? I mean, everybody's looking to be original.
Yeah.
I mean, the irony I find in television to some degree with some networks like, you know, TNT or something, we want to be like, more like Mad Men type of shows.
Yes.
And you're like, did you see the Mad Men ratings? They would not be happy. They want Rizzoli and Isles ratings, and they don't. Do you know what you want? I mean, this is what I'm asking of these networks. Do you know what you really want? Because you seem to be confused. You don't.
Yeah.
You want the big numbers. But I don't know. I mean, Lifetime, I think, probably does want the big numbers.
Yeah. I mean, well, the interesting thing, like what we were talking about before, is that cross-section of sort of populism and pop and then huge gravitas. For me, that weird, like, contradiction I've been living my whole life was sort of perfect in this space of them being like, we really want to make your weird thing. We really need to do something different. We're totally interested in expanding the brand. And it's like very female forward. So there was also something really feminist about it. Like there was like no problem about having two female leads. Like it didn't even, there wasn't even a conversation.
That's unusual.
Totally unusual. And I think there was a little bit of a sense of, you know, I was a wild card, throw it at the wall, see if it sticks. And it gave me a lot of freedom. And they haven't wavered once, which is unbelievable. They really actually stuck by the short.
Did you find yourself trying to test them? Like, well, what if I have her do this? Then really.
I did. There were a couple things. You know, like I think that gross, sometimes I get a little gross. It was a little too gross sometimes. But there were times that Nina pushed me darker. She said, I can tell you're kind of dancing around it because you're worried about us. And she just said, just go darker.
Wow. It sounds kind of dreamy.
It was a little dreamy. Yeah. It was a little dreamy and super surprising.
Yeah. I would say very surprising.
Yeah.
So when you had the show at Lifetime, Marty Noxon came into the game. And I assume because they wanted an experienced showrunner, that's how it always works, right?
Absolutely, yes.
And how did they match you guys? Did you like have a date and decide at the end? Or was it like The Bachelor kind of and there were a whole bunch of showrunners and
no.
You had a rose?
We had an incredible first date. I love Marty and my first date is like one of my favorite things. Nina actually had reached out to her very personally, and they had been trying to work with Marty, I think, for years, and they just hadn't found the right project. They hadn't found anything that quite fit, and she reached out to Marty personally and told her she had to come in and see the short film, and Marty, I guess, was bowled over. She should talk about that, but she just said, yeah, like, if you really are going to do that, if you're really going to do the short, I would do it. And then we had lunch, and I think it was just sort of about Marty deciding if she wanted to work with me. I mean, we could pretend it was about us deciding on each other, but I think it was.
Of course, she has Buffy, the Vampire Slayer, and worked on Mad Men.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, she's got a good pedigree at this point.
Yeah, she was incredible. And so our first lunch, we sat down, and it was just kind of like a Vulcan mind meld. We really just had like an absolute love affair with each other from the start. And I think it was kind of a great
match.
Yeah,
complimentary match.
Yeah.
So as far as reality now, I assume you're not watching tons of it.
I don't watch it, no.
It's not your guilty pleasure?
It's not. It doesn't make me very happy.
No.
No.
I mean, the business is it's not what it was in the day. I mean, reality has taken a bit of a beating lately.
Yeah.
All right. We are not sad about that.
Uh-uh.
No. Strangely, The Bachelor is still going strong, I think. But aspirational became this big buzzword, and I guess people maybe burned out a little bit on the kind of humiliation of certain shows.
Yeah, I think so. I also just think, you know, I think sometimes people get tired of looking at their own lives and they just kind of want to hear like a well-crafted story from a really thoughtful place that isn't just kind of a train wreck. I think it's fun to watch the human train wreck for a while, but I just feel like people's tastes and sensibilities have evolved a lot as television has gotten so incredible over the, you know, past, I don't know, it was like 9 years sort of, that maybe the tolerance for the human train wreck is
diminishing a little.
Yeah, a little bit.
Sarah Gertrude Shapiro is the co-creator of Unreal, which is now airing on Lifetime. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
How does it feel to be one of the beautiful people?
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna and Melissa Morton. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
How does it feel to be?